So you're listening to the Taylor Reports in CIT. We have Mr. Gowans with us yet? We're going to call him, right?
No, I'm here.
Oh, my gosh, you're there. Well, that's not fair. How much of that did you have to be subjected to?
Well, I enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Well, it's apropos, the Cuba situation, and you have a great piece about their access to freedom and all. But I better start off. This is Stephen Gowan. I better start off and remind people. The burning issue of the day was, shall we go to war again? Because it's August and it's time for war games, and we learn that there might be, and we have ugly encounters. The excuse for this one was that it was some landmines exploded and did damage to South Korean soldiers, I take it. And immediately we're told, well, that's North Korea all over again. And there was propaganda broadcast along the border. I don't understand what that's about. I'll ask you. But tell us, why do we have this ugly near and again nuclear armed soldiers forces on either side? They have to go through this. What's this one about?
What's the current conflict? I think it's important to point out that the key element in all of this is these massive war games that are going on in South Korea. They're called the Ulji Freedom Guardian War Games. And these involve 80,000 troops, 50,000 South Korean troops, 27,000 U.S. troops who would normally be stationed on South Korean soil, plus another 3,000 that have been brought in from elsewhere, so 80,000 troops. The United States and South Korea routinely practice these military exercises, and they have three forms of them. One is called Key Resolve, which is practicing to bring U.S. reinforcements into South Korea. The other one's called Full Eagle, which is about securing the rear area, and some say is really about putting down any kind of civil uprising in South Korea.
Which has occurred.
Yes. And then the third one is the current one that's underway. It began in August, or August 17th, and it's going to run for a month. And this one is about invading the North. So understandably, the North Koreans are always a little agitated when these war games are being carried out. And they've expressed their concern about this. And their concerns are always dismissed on the grounds that these are routine. But as some have pointed out, a man may routinely abuse a woman, but that doesn't make the abuse any less unjust. Mm-hmm. So in the midst of these war games, the war games are about to begin, and I should mention that the U.S. has brought in B-2 stealth bombers and F-22A Raptor stealth tactical fighters. And they recently, I believe on Saturday, they deliberately made some practice bombing runs near the North Korean border. So these are highly provocative war games. They're always provocative. Mm-hmm. And yet, despite the fact that it's the United States and South Korea that are engaged in this obvious provocation, suddenly, just before the war games are about to begin, we have this story about the landmine. So apparently two South Korean soldiers on patrol in the demilitarized zone stepped on some landmines that were said to be North Korean landmines. And the South Koreans immediately said, well, it was the North Koreans who deliberately planted those because, you know, they're provocative and belligerent. This is the kind of routine provocation we would expect from North Korea. The North Koreans said, we didn't do that. And some others at the time, when this initially happened, suggested this is very likely an accident because there have been hundreds of people who have inadvertently stepped on mines in and around the demilitarized zone. Mm-hmm. It's a highly mined zone, and flooding and other events can lead to the shifting of mines.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the South Koreans rejected that explanation. And the press has been, the Western media has been exceedingly deceptive in saying, well, you know, also the UN has investigated, and the UN has said that this couldn't have been accidental. It must have been deliberately done by the North Koreans. And the UN sounds like some kind of neutral organization, but the UN is really none other in Korea than the U.S. military.
Yeah.
So it's not really surprising that the U.S. military might take an ambiguous situation, a situation which, you know, it's not really clear what happened, but there's a good likelihood that this was accidental, and use this ambiguous situation for propaganda purposes to portray the South or the North Koreans, rather, as being provocative and belligerent.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to Stephen Gowans, and Stephen, you've made the point in the past, which I'm always marveled at. You say that the commander, legal official commander of the South Korean army, is a U.S. general.
Yeah, and in many respects, I mean, to use common parlance, South Korea is kind of a joke because it's the only nation in the world in which a foreign military has operational control over its armed forces.
They must have a U.S. customs at their airport like Toronto, right?
That's right. Yes, yeah, so
very special relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that is ultimately, and then you, at this moment, we have, of course, the Secretary General of the United Nations who claims he wants to be helpful. He is himself a South Korean politician. So that's almost a trifecta.
Well, yes, exactly.
When he puts his two cents, you would think he'd actually say, I better recuse myself from this. He's got too much of an interest. He can't hide that.
Mm-hmm. No, and the North Koreans almost always are isolated and stand almost entirely alone in the world. Although I might make mention of the fact that the Syrians are behind them. That might make difference in material terms, but
yeah. How to win friends and influence people.
But interestingly, because of this the so-called mine event or incident, the South Koreans decided to resume their so-called propaganda broadcast across the border. So they've taken a bunch of mobile speakers that have a range of up to 24 kilometers, and they broadcast, you know, propaganda into North Korea.
Do we know what they're saying in those blasted broadcasts?
Well, it's interesting. If you read some of the press reports, they say, oh, it's nothing really. It's, you know, like some news and information and weather. It's not really propaganda. And then they mention, oh, and there are also stories about people who have defected from the north to the south, talking about how wonderful life is in the south compared to the north.
Well, also, I mean, you must have seen it just about 2 or 3 weeks ago. There's a woman in South Korea being treated like a dog because she wants to return to North Korea.
Yes.
And so once you're embraced by freedom, freedom don't let you go, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought I was going to suggest that maybe they should be shouting, our commander is an American, or our leading families collaborated with the Japanese. We're still occupied. Those would be really important things to shout to the North, right? Shake them up.
It would be. And you know, that's an interesting distinction between North Korea and South Korea. You mentioned our leaders collaborated with the Japanese. And the North Korean leaders did the exact opposite. They were at the forefront of...
collaborated with the Americans.
Yeah, at the forefront of the guerrilla war against the Japanese and rejecting domination by a foreign hegemon, whereas the South Korean regime was one that accepted domination, first by Japan, which they collaborated with, and then by the United States, which they collaborate with, to the point, as we've just pointed out, of allowing the U.S. to have operational control over their military.
Mm-hmm.
They've also been very keen to volunteer, not to volunteer, but to send South Korean forces and troops into battle on behalf of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They did so in Vietnam. done so in Afghanistan. They've done so in Iraq. But if we look at North Korean troops, they haven't served outside of their borders.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Hollywood demonizes, Washington demonizes. I noticed the title for their war games is ULGI Freedom Guard. Do you know what that means? What's that indicate beyond the word freedom and guardian? I got that part, but is there some special about that?
I don't know what the significance is.
This has to do with eagles and victory and such thing.
It would be more descriptive if it was called Invade Pyongyang Exercises, which really wasn't all about.
Well, and apropos of that, there is this issue of nuclear weapons, and you quote an American commander, or I forget his rank, but he threatened to reduce North Korea to a charcoal briquette, a brisket.
That was Colin Powell when he was...
Oh, Colin Powell. I think he's a liberal. I forgot. Yeah. Charming people. Hey, by the way, that kind of talk is supposed to be... That actually isn't tolerated according to international law. You know, you can't threaten that way.
And yet...
If you're talking about nuclear... threatening nuclear war is supposed to be considered, beyond the pale.
And yet the United States has threatened nuclear war multiple times against North Korea and other countries as well.
I think you numbered them, didn't you? The number of times they've threatened, even threatened Syria with a nuclear war.
Yeah, it was between 1970 and 2010, they have threatened countries with nuclear attack on 25 separate occasions. Five of those times against North Korea. Iraq 7 times, China 4 times, the USSR 4 times, Libya twice, Iran once, and Syria once.
It's just remarkable. We have to have this war story every August. We've interviewed you in the past where it comes August, and they insist on having these games. And as I recall, actually, in a previous interview, there was an island which was a matter of dispute as to sovereignty, and they were shelling it, the South Korean Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a war. I mean, there's just no getting around it. If you fire on this territory which is in dispute, you are... clearly the one guilty. I mean, it's terrible. Fortunately, the consequences don't come from this, but that's outrageous that this conduct happens year in and year out with no one raising basically any opposition. I'm not aware of the Russians. I know that they don't go along with it, but I'm not aware of their making statements on behalf of
them. I mean, this August as well. And that has been attributed to the North Koreans, or at least the initiation of it has been. The South Koreans say, oh, the North Koreans fired shells at us. And the reason they did that is because they're trying to dissuade us or induce us to stop these propaganda broadcasts. Mm-hmm. The North Koreans said, we didn't shell you. We didn't set those mines. And we're worried now that what you're doing is you're using these events as a pretext for an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that's what you're doing because you have 80,000 troops. 80,000 troops who are on maneuvers. You're doing practice bombing runs along the border. Mm-hmm. And now you're attributing to us provocations that we're not responsible for. So are you looking for pretext? Also, it's interesting. There had been talks going on between both sides, the North Koreans and the South Koreans, to try and de-escalate.
Mm-hmm.
It was the North Koreans who initiated the talks.
Mm-hmm.
The South Koreans are being very inflexible and saying, well, we're going to continue the war games. We're not going to stop those. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue the propaganda broadcast unless you apologize.
Yes.
Apologize for your provocations.
Yes.
I should also point out that you said this happens every August.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago in August, they had the ULGI Freedom Guardian War Games, as we do annually. And later on in the month, after the war games were over, there was a story that appeared in the Wall Street Journal that said, oh, yeah, by the way, the White House and Pentagon cooked up what they called their playbook for North Korea. And they deliberately planned to rattle the North Koreans more than they usually do. And the way they decided to do that was to have B-52s fly close to the North Korean border, low altitude, and during the day. And they said, we could have done it at night, but the point was for the North Koreans to see the bombers. And we knew that this would really agitate them because we know they remember what happened to them from 1950 to 1953 when we destroyed just about every building in North Korea.
Yes.
And they said, we did this deliberately, and we knew how they would react. We knew that they would start making what is called in the Western media threats. But that was our plan. I mean, and this is what happens every year.
Yeah.
And it's deliberate. It's a deliberate way to intimidate the North Koreans and to impose this enormous self-defense burden on them.
Yeah. And our, what they call the political classes, or something, tolerate it and are totally comfortable with that kind of behavior. No one stands up and says, you know, is it is really right or legal to do that to a state with whom you have difficult relations? Everybody's on sides, NDP, Green, Liberal, Democrat, Republican, Labor, et cetera. Last point on that is you also point out that there is some method in the madness on the side in that they hope to bankrupt North Korea, basically, by forcing them into a defense posture at all times. Another vast expenditures, which for a poor economy is very hard to do.
Yeah, that, and on top of that, I mean, North Korea is the most heavily sanctioned country in the world, and it has been sanctioned since 1945. The North Koreans estimate that those sanctions have cost them $16 trillion. Between 1945 and 2015. Mm. And so that, on top of these enormous expenditures, has crippled the economy. And there's some, Tim Beal, who's a retired academic from New Zealand who closely follows Asian politics, who's argued that, you know, this economic warfare on top of what he calls subcritical warfare to cripple the economy has had enormous humanitarian consequences in terms of starvation, child malnutrition, disease. And his argument is that this is one of the greatest unacknowledged crimes of our time.
Hmm.
And it's interesting to ask, well, why is it unacknowledged? Why? I mean, we can talk about the blockade on Cuba, or you can talk about the effect of sanctions on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But why don't we talk about the enormous humanitarian consequences of sanctions on North Korea?
Mm-hmm.
He does make an interesting point, which is that one of the reasons why is because the North Koreans don't want to admit their vulnerability, so they don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans don't want to acknowledge the harm they're inflicting, so they don't talk about it either.
Yeah, well, they don't want a Madeleine Albright moment where she says, it's worth it.
No, exactly.
Kind of a blurt out. Where people
exactly.
say, oh, 500,000 dead,
but
worth it.
But
they're doing it to Yemen right now, actually.
But the North Koreans have been acknowledging, though, that that the United States is deliberately trying to cripple their economy.
Yeah.
And they point out that the war games, that's one of the intentions of the war games, and they say that it does have an impact on the standard of living of their population.
Sure. Well, that's it's Stephen Gowans, by the way, gowans.wordpress.com. What's left? I don't know why I put a question mark. There's no question mark. What's left? Which is, I'll get it right. All these years, Stephen, I was still working on saying it correctly. So the title of your article apropos of Cuba is Cuba's low level of internet use, not a policy of restricting the flow of information. There is a story, and we've certainly all seen it, and it's talked about it. I've seen members of the Toronto Star and others saying, oh, the Cubans really envy us. Naturally, all these things are based on the concept of they want to be us. And Cuba's use of the internet is has been studied, and you've certainly examined the numbers. You have come to different conclusions using the World Bank's figures as to what the explains the level of usage of the internet by Cuba. So, what did you conclude?
Well, I should mention that there's a parallel here with North Korea. So you deliberately cripple the North Korean economy, and then the Western media likes to say, why are the North Koreans poor? Well, because it's mismanagement of their economy. Mm-hmm. So the parallel here is, what is always said in the Western media about Cuba? Well, if there's something that doesn't seem as good in Cuba as it is in the West, it must have something to do with, in this case they say, it's those Cubans. They're trying to restrict the flow of information because they don't want, the government doesn't want Cuban citizens to know what's going on in the rest of the world, because if they knew, then they might overthrow their government. So they're deliberately restricting the flow of information. But, a more likely and plausible explanation for why there's a low level of internet use in Cuba is because Cuba is an underdeveloped country. And so you might expect to have a low level of internet use in a country that has a comparatively low GDP per capita. So what I did was I went and I took a look at the World Bank data, and I looked at internet use per 100 people by country, and then I correlated that with GDP per capita per country. And when you do that, you find a strong relationship, and you look at where Cuba is, and Cuba is exactly where you would expect Cuba to be, given that its level of economic development. So the degree of the level of internet use per 100 people in Cuba is equal to the degree or the level of internet use per 100 people among countries that have the same level of economic development.
Mm-hmm.
That's a more plausible and, parsimonious explanation for why there's a low level of internet use in Cuba than the Cuban government's trying to restrict the flow of information.
Hmm. Well, and you actually call out the countries. Cuba is actually ahead of India, are they not?
They're far ahead of India.
India and Haiti. By the way, Haiti has been permanently under U.S. Marine rules for a long, long time. How come they don't, America hasn't denied them free access to all the wonderful things that you can get on the internet?
Yeah, so this argument is, Cuba's totalitarian. That's why they have a low level of internet use. But the level of internet use is exactly the same as it is in Central America, where the United States has spent a lot of time trying to keep that region free from communist totalitarianism.
And particularly, you name the country that they've devoted, really are passionately committed to, Honduras, where they overthrew the government. There was a coup, and the people of Honduras had found a new leader, and the Americans got rid of him because he was elected. And Honduras doesn't have as much internet use as Cuba.
Yes, by a fair degree as well.
I got to get Kerry on the phone. There's something wrong here. These numbers don't compute. But the arrogance, you could cut it with a knife. Also, you mentioned South Korea. You go into this thing, who does repress? And by the way, I should move it to that, because the suggestion is, Cuba's trying to limit what people see. But you say, you want to look at that, you better talk to the United States itself and Canada. Could you enlarge on that?
Well, you go through a certain, the capitalist, the so-called free capitalist countries that are allies of the United States. If you look at South Korea is, one of the most robust police states in the world. And it... if a computer user in South Korea clicks on an item on the North Korean Twitter account, the government warning pops up saying, you can't look at this. This is illegal. In 2011, South Korean authorities blocked over 53,000 internet posts for infractions, which included, things mm-hmm. like having a kind word to say about North Korea.
Well, now that brings us to U.S. You cite that the U.S. closed, was it 80 sites advocating trade with Cuba?
Yeah, 80 over 80 websites related to Cuba.
They were deleted.
That's right.
Put out of business.
Right.
By
and
the,
then we have
Levers of Freedom.
One in Canada, which gives CSIS the authority to restrict the flow of information on the web by disrupting radical websites, whatever they are, mm-hmm. and removing terrorist propaganda, and the definition of terrorism is very broad.
Yeah. A radical website is one that makes fun of Stephen Harper's hair. That's. I heard that Atwood's article disappeared. I don't know if Atwood has. If she's out there, just call and let us know you're safe. Curious. And, of course, you point out Turkey does this. And Turkey,
I mean, there are thousands of websites in Turkey that are blocked by the state, and they never say why.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, a very important matter, too, and this is Stephen Gowan's what's left the site, and, of course, it's gowans.wordpress.com. You touch on something which they have a glamour figure, this woman, Yoani Sanchez. Mm. And everybody's, oh, Yoani is the only voice for freedom in Cuba. And, boy, there's some strange things about her site. Could you tell us some of the details about her?
Yeah, you see this often with these apparently grassroots organizations. It's a grassroots blogger. And yet her website's available in 18 languages. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Where did she get
pick
the money?
Myself up.
Who's doing all the translation?
As one who lives in the grass, I know grass from artificial turf, I can tell you.
And, I mean, this is obviously something that the United States is behind.
Yeah, and they don't account for that. The site of it, I think you calculate, that thing is worth a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's just, you know, poor, you know, Sanchez, the grassroots blogger.
Yeah, so she's obviously not paying for this. Yeah. And, I mean, when you consider that, you know, the United States has initiated a de facto state of war with Cuba. So...
And beating them out, as your article points out, of billions of dollars. And I noticed Fidel Castro has recently reminded everybody of that because the Americans are already saying, well, we want the United Fruit Company back and we want the ranches. They owe Cuba quite a bit, actually.
Yes, they owe Cuba, or at least some have estimated that the cost of the blockade against Cuba is about $1 trillion.
That could go towards buying a few tractors.
And, yeah, and others have estimated that were it not for the blockade, that the Cuban economy might be on par with economies in Western Europe, in which yeah. case they'd have a much higher level of Internet usage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they would be able to find out about Donald Trump for themselves. This is Stephen Gowans. What about the robust democracy to the north, the envy of the world, the free system? You're using a term I noticed, a type of democracy, procedural democracy. And you say that you start off with Mr. Krugman of the New York Times, who thinks the Republicans are too interested in money. You seem to be chiding him that maybe it's not just the Republicans. Tell us what kind of democracy do they have there?
Yeah, well, Krugman, I mean, has been making the point for the last few years that the United States is a plutocracy, so it's a society that's governed or dominated anyway by the wealthy. And it's kind of interesting to look at how it is that he came to this conclusion. You know, as an economist, he's making these prescriptions about what to do with respect to austerity or against austerity and saying, no one's listening to me. Why is it? No one follows the economic doctrine. Why is what's going on here? It looks like all of these economic decisions are made to promote the interests of the wealthy. So he starts asking, well, why is that? How does this happen? And so, you know, he starts to articulate some of the mechanisms by which organized business groups and wealthy individuals are able to dominate politics in the United States. And what he's doing is kind of rediscovering what people who've worked in, say, a Marxist tradition have been talking about for decades, if not over a century.
It's capitalism, stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that is what it is, right? I mean, you have a class system. It's dominated by a narrow group. Some people call them, as you point out in the article, the 1%. Well, mm-hmm. you don't undo that unless you get rid of the 1%.
Yes.
And then you would have a democracy.
Yeah. So
or at
I
least a chance
it
for
it. Procedural democracy because, you know, there's this assumption that, well, if you have multi-party elections, it's a democracy. So, but yeah, but you don't talk about the outcomes or the type of society. Do multi-party elections within the context of a capitalist society lead to outcomes where the bulk of people benefit? And it obviously, that isn't the case.
Yeah.
So it seems to me it's more important to look at the outcome in terms of assessing whether your society is democratic than to look at the procedures.
Yeah.
I mean, if the procedures don't create the right outcome, then the procedures are kind of meaningless.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are three great articles, Stephen. We're really glad, particularly this latter one. I would probably ought to come back to that because we have the elections are coming up soon, and that ought to be talked about, particularly in light of what's happening with Mr. Corbyn, who's finally raised the flag of socialism again in British politics. Stephen Gowans, it's a great pleasure to talk to you.
You too. Thank you.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And remember, on the 26th of August at the Different Book List, 746 Bathurst, Black Lives Matter is going to be speaking. And so, Henny Phil, thanks very much, and we'll see you next week.